The MMQB podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off on your first tickets. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code TheMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. I'd like to propose a drinking game for our listeners, if you indulge. Take a shot or drink your beer every time Andy says stylistically, and you'll have a great night. There was a kind of a kerfuffle in the Ravens locker room where I was told to leave, and I declined to, and some words were exchanged. Yeah.
Very good. And you were like in your early 20s, too.
I was scared out of my mind. Thank you for joining us. We've got another jam-packed hour. I'm Robert Klimko, a reporter for the MMQB, as is Andy Benoit. Today we're going to have a visit with Xavier Rhodes, the cornerback for the Minnesota Vikings, who just had a strong game against Calvin Johnson of the Lions. Outside of that, we're going to preview all of the games, and soon we are going to actually pick these games.
We're not going to do that. We're going to avoid that. Come on.
We'll talk about it at some point.
Yeah, because we've been emailing all day. Hey, you know one other thing, and then I'll get all my gripes out of the way.
Yeah.
Can we totally avoid any talk of these like 0-2 holes, you know, and teams don't make the playoffs at this percent of the time if they start 0-2, and all that tragic stuff that happens when you start 0-2. No team in the history of the NFL has ever missed the playoffs because they went 0-2. So I hope we can avoid that kind of stuff, the overreaction to the first 2 weeks of the season. And also, it hasn't been a crazy NFL season. They're all crazy.
Well, I think it's fair to say that there are certain teams who started 0-2 and probably weren't going to make the playoffs, whether they started 2-0 or 1-1.
Right, right.
Yeah, and vice versa.
Correct, yeah. And look, is it better to be 2-0 than 0-2? Yeah, absolutely. But it's the Seattle, Indianapolis, Baltimore, it's not time to just sell your stock in these teams.
Okay. With that in mind, we'll jump right into it. Kansas City Chiefs this week at the Green Bay Packers. The Packers won a game that I was at Lambeau against the Seahawks 27-17, dropping the Seahawks to 0-2. And the Chiefs lost to the Broncos last week, 31-24. Now, I was at this performance at Lambeau. It was a tremendous game. Went down to the wire in a lot of respects. Obviously, some key pieces missing on Seattle's side. Certainly, Cam Chancellor would have made the Seahawks more competitive in that game. And yet, Aaron Rodgers has still not thrown an interception at Lambeau since week 13 of 2012. Obviously, that's an incredible streak. I don't know what the record is. I imagine he's approaching it at some point here. But why, in your mind, is Aaron Rodgers so effective at home? Do you think it boils down to him being probably one of the top three quarterbacks in the NFL and having the advantage of a quiet fan base on offense?
It might, but, you know, it's such a small sample size if we're to analyze Aaron Rodgers' interceptions, because the ones he has thrown, I think it was our colleague Greg Bishop wrote in the magazine last week, it was either 4 out of 5 or 3 out of 4 of his most recent interceptions, or the interceptions he had last season, were balls that still hit his receiver's hands. So we're talking about a quarterback who doesn't throw interceptions, and anytime you have that, you know, he's not going to throw them at home. I mean, it's probably a coincidence, if anything, but Rodgers is very good in the pre-snap phase, and it's easier to play in the pre-snap phase at home than on the road. Maybe that does have something to do with it. I don't know, but I don't know if there's any discussion at this point that he's the best quarterback in the NFL, given that he plays behind a better offensive line than Andrew Luck, and probably better than Tom Brady's for that matter. And he's got an unparalleled raw skill set. The reason I brought up Luck is because Luck to me is the only other guy in the league who can create the way Rodgers creates. And of the two, I think Rodgers is clearly having the better season, and he can create a greater variety of ways because he doesn't have to set his feet when he throws, and Luck does. Almost every quarterback does. So the rules of quarterbacking don't apply to Rodgers, and the interceptions is just it's one of the latest examples of how they don't apply.
Not only does he have a great offensive line, but he also has the benefit of what looks like one of the best 1-2 running back combinations in the NFL. Eddie Lacy goes out early in that game, and James Starks ends up rushing for 95 yards on 20 carries. I don't think anybody saw that coming.
I've always, for the longest time anyway, I've kind of thought that James Starks is a better fit for their offense than Lacy. I don't think he's the better player, but stylistically, he's got more initial quickness. He's a little more wiggle to him laterally, and he still has decent power. He's not Lacy-type power, but for what Green Bay wants to do, where they spread their receivers outside the numbers and they want to spread the field, Starks is a good style of running back to have for that. Lacy works for them as well, but you're right. That's a tremendous 1-2 punch, and now they're going up against the Chiefs' run defense. I don't know what the numbers have said, but on film, this Chiefs' run defense has been absolutely one of the best in the league this season, with Don Terry Poe and Jay Howard leading the way up front. So this is strength on strength, and Green Bay will run the ball against a good run defense. They're not going to become one-dimensional. That's one of the other things that sets them apart from Brady's team, actually, and Andrew Luck's team.
It's certainly a heavyweight matchup on that side of the ball. The Chiefs forced 5 turnovers on Thursday night against the Broncos, and that was the most during the Andy Reid era in Kansas City. As an aside, I'd like to propose a drinking game for our listeners, if you indulge. Take a shot or drink your beer every time Andy says stylistically, and you'll have a great night.
Oh, you mean for the show, not for a game? For our show. All right. The other one I say is I use the term I'm curious to see. I say that way too much.
Yeah.
So – you know, if you are really into what did you call it, partaking or engaging or whatever the word was, your euphemism for drinking?
Imbibing.
There it is. If you're really into that, then also include anytime I say I'm curious to see.
Let's move on to the Broncos at the Lions. The Broncos are 2-0, beating the Chiefs 31-24 last week. And the Detroit Lions are 0-2, having fallen to the Vikings 26-16. We're going to talk to Xavier Rhodes a little bit later about the success that he had against Calvin Johnson. But before we get to that, the Vikings ran the ball 42 times in this game and still averaged 4.7 yards per carry against Detroit. Did the Vikings simply block better than they have in the past, or could this be an ongoing problem for the Lions?
Well, with DeAndre Levy out of the lineup, it's a different type of run defense. They're without their linchpin there. So I wouldn't be too worried if I'm a Lions fan yet. I think their D-line's playing okay against the run, just okay. Nothing better, nothing worse. But Haloti Ngata and Tyron Walker, those guys are very good at maintaining double teams. And when you have, and by that I mean not letting the double team get off of them and up to the linebacker. So they clog the middle, in other words. And when you have that element, then guys like Levy who can really run, that's a plus for them. So I wouldn't get carried away with Detroit's run D. I'd be more concerned with the other side of the ball. They cannot run the ball effectively on offense. And the Vikings, as we talked as Rhodes about, they stayed back in two safeties deep the entire game on Sunday and still dominated Detroit's run game. And when you can do that, that ultimately that impacts your passing game as well. And it's going to lead to inconsistencies, and especially with a guy like Stafford, who's been known to be a little bit of a wild stallion, as they call him. So I think that's the biggest issue in Detroit right now, is the lack of balance that we're seeing on offense. And what are they going to do to fix it? Because it's the problem is their offensive line. It's not the skill positions. Their offensive line has not been very good in the ground game.
Yeah. On the other side of the ball, it doesn't seem like the Lions will even have to use two safeties on a consistent basis. When you look at the way Peyton Manning is throwing the ball, he's his accurate self, but there doesn't seem to be any zip to it, and certainly a lot of caution. They've yet to complete a pass longer than 25 yards this season. Now, that could be a misleading stat because it's only been 2 weeks in the season. But if you watch these games, I think there's something noticeably different about the way Peyton's throwing the ball.
No, yeah, I agree. And I didn't mean to interrupt you. What I was going to say is he's been accurate except when he's had to stretch the field. And he has not been the same deep ball thrower. He has not been accurate when he has pushed the ball downfield. He doesn't have the juice right now, and it's worse now than it's ever been. I want to see them get away from this Kubiak offense stuff. I think Manning, if you're going to have Peyton Manning, and at this point a diminished Peyton Manning, then you need to let him amplify every strength that he has. And if the arm's not there anymore, then what's left is the pre-snap phase of the game, the intelligence, diagnosing the defense, getting the ball out quickly, throwing 10 yards or less, which is what Denver did, I believe, more than any team in the NFL since Manning has arrived in Denver. That's his game, and controlling it with no huddle at the line of scrimmage. We're not seeing that stuff right now. And they're trying to merge a Kubiak system with Manning, and we're here, and it's more about Kubiak. That cannot remain the case. It doesn't match the quarterback. It doesn't match their personnel, and it doesn't play to their strengths. And I would hope it would start this week. Manning has to be the guy in charge in this offense. When Denver's gone to no huddle, they've looked like a totally different team than when they played in what we're calling the Kubiak system.
This next game is one that I'll be visiting: Bengals at Ravens. The Bengals defense was very strong against the Chargers last week, 24-19 win there. And the Ravens lost to the Raiders in a stunner, 37-33. I was actually in the Green Bay press box and caught the end of that one. One of the better victories in the last 10 years for the Raiders, and one of the worst losses for the Ravens. The Ravens played that game without Terrell Suggs. How big of an impact did that have?
It certainly had more of an impact than I thought it would. Baltimore has good depth, and so I thought they could move the next guy up, which in this case would be Courtney Upshaw. But what you lose with that is the perimeter speed. Upshaw's not an edge speed guy. He's a good all-around player, similar to Suggs in that sense, but he doesn't have the initial first step that Suggs has. And what that means, that might seem like a small thing, but it's a big thing, because what that means is now not only can teams slide their protections more to Elvis Dumervil, who the last two seasons has been feasting on favorable matchups, but Baltimore's going to have to manufacture a pass rush through blitzes. They can do that. They're good enough to do that. It wasn't a factor against Oakland, though, because the Raiders went to this spread out, quick three-step timing passing game, which is what Derek Carr is clearly best at, and that's going to nullify most blitz concepts. So the more you have to manufacture pressure, the easier you are to play against in a lot of ways, because certain schemes can wipe out other schemes. Examples, the spread wiping out the blitzes. So I'll be curious. I'll be very interested to see I'm keeping our listeners safe. I'll be interested to see what Cincinnati does in their approach this week, if they also spread out and try to get the ball out of Dalton's hands quickly. That's not always their MO, but they're certainly more than capable of playing that way.
Here was a surprise to me from Cincinnati's last game. Jeremy Hill gets benched in favor of Gio Bernard after losing his second fumble of the day. When I think of Jeremy Hill, I fumbles don't come to mind. So I looked it up here. He only fumbled 5 times last year, which I think is probably on the good end for starting running backs, guys with over 200 carries. What did you see was his big problem on Sunday?
I don't know if you can really get into breaking down fumbles.
Yeah. Unless it's a Patriots game and you know why they don't fumble.
Okay. And really, fumbles, I mean, again, it's kind of back to that small sample size. If he's had 5 last year, he had 2 in this game, it very well could be a coincidence. I've always been surprised how much coaches punish running backs for fumbling, though. It seems like if a guy doesn't get benched after certainly a second fumble and sometimes even a first, it's unusual anymore. Adrian Peterson, by the way, he fumbled 3 times against Detroit. And fortunately, Minnesota's not talking about playing Jerick McKinnon every snap. I wouldn't read too much into the Jeremy Hill fumbling thing. And even if it becomes a quote-unquote problem, they're not going to ultimately bench Jeremy Hill in the long run.
Yeah. I remember in high school it was a big thing. If you fumbled, you probably weren't going to play the rest of the game. But in the NFL, it seems like, I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive that you would treat your starting running back like that.
Well, I think we all know you shouldn't turn the ball over in football. And I think we take that for granted sometimes. I'm always reminded of this as I start watching film more during this season. And when you watch the film, you really see how turnovers impact strategy. Because when you fumble, three things happen, all negative things. One, you lose possession, which means you lose a chance at points. So take away one of your drives. Two, you give them an extra drive. So that swings it in two ways. And three is you all automatically lose the field position battle, because wherever you are in the field, that's where they are now on the field, or worse for you. So it's – and those are three – I mean, we're talking about opportunities at points and position on the field, which is ultimately another form of opportunities at points. So it gets football down to its most basic and its most essence, and coaches absolutely hate it for those reasons, and it's hard to strategize around. It totally throws kinks into a game plan. There's nothing you can do about it other than get mad and bench a guy.
Yeah, I know we're not picking games yet, but I do want to pick this one because I think we may disagree. I like the Ravens here just because they've put a lot of emphasis on beating Cincinnati after losing to them twice last season. One in the season opener and then another in week 8. And I just feel like coming off the loss to the Raiders that the Ravens are going to have a whole new kind of focus going into this one. It's one of those games that you pick based on circumstance and not necessarily based on matchup. But I'd be interested to know if you were being forced to pick, who would you pick?
I'd probably take Baltimore because I'm big in standing by what you came into the season believing all through September. I don't, you know, Cincinnati's been better these first 2 weeks. Baltimore's been a little bit of a disappointment, although they were very competitive defensively against Denver, which would have changed the whole narrative about their West Coast trip if they'd pulled that one off. So the evidence and the film analyst to me is supposed to pick Cincinnati, but I'm picking Baltimore, I guess, if you're making me pick. By the way, how do you enjoy going to Ravens games? Because I know you've made a little bit of a name for yourself in the NFL media community for some rough roads that you were kind of forced to travel early in your career in Baltimore.
I do enjoy going to games. And the cool thing about the NFL is that I think it's easy to mend broken fences as long as you haven't, push them past the point of no return. You know, I have a good relationship with those guys now, whereas there was some friction early on when we were reporting at USA Today on Ray Lewis at the end of his career, and the NFL wanted to make him some sort of ambassador of the league, and we brought back up the old murders. But, you know, a couple years down the road, the whole roster turns over, the locker room's different, and you kind of just make nice.
And it probably – what kind of relationship did you have with Suggs?
I don't think anybody in the media there has a really good relationship with him, and I was no different.
Okay. Yeah.
He always
– Yeah. Oh, I wish we could – we probably have stories we can't tell, huh?
Well, he always resented that the Baltimore Sun and others reported on the former occupation of his wife.
Okay. I haven't heard. What was that? Can you report on it now?
I mean, at some point she was an exotic dancer.
Oh, all right. Answer this or plead the fifth, and then we'll move on to the next game, because I know we're kind of beating around the bush and our listeners are probably interested. I've heard that Suggs once got up in your face and was, quote unquote, wagging his finger in your face. Is that true or not true?
It wasn't quite like that, but he did. There was a kind of a kerfuffle in the Ravens locker room where I was told to leave, and I declined to, and some words were exchanged.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. And you were like in your early 20s too.
I was scared out of my mind. Bears. Okay. Bears at Seahawks. This is one we don't need to spend a lot of time on. The Bears are.
Well, except we have our obligatory Cam Chancellor discussion for this week, especially now that this holdout is over. That screwed up your article too, I'm guessing.
No, I just added a couple lines. The Bears are 0-2. The Seahawks also somehow 0-2. I think they're a team that we feel like that 0-2 doesn't matter as much as it does for the Bears. I'll give you a couple observations from Lambeau that you can tell me if you agree or disagree with. I thought the play of their center, Drew Nowak, and their offensive line as a whole, especially the interior, really limited what they were able to do on offense. I think they had to go to a lot more play action, a lot more waggle stuff, some read option stuff. It took Jimmy Graham out of the game because he wasn't able to operate in the slot as much as he has grown accustomed to from his time in New Orleans. And I think that there's no quick fix there on that interior line, and it's something that Darrell Bevell is going to have to get really creative to work around.
I agree with you. There is not a quick fix with that O-line. It's a remade, a revamped group. It's not the most talented group, and its issues begin in the middle. And that's very hard, especially if you want to run as much zone concepts as they run. If you're not decent in the middle, you cannot be a zone-running team. So Bevell will have to adjust. Now, the good news is he has a quarterback who's probably better out of structure than he is in structure. And Seattle's offense also came to life once Russell Wilson's legs became a factor in that game the other night. So it's not the worst case. I think another concern, you mentioned it, Jimmy Graham, they don't appear to have a plan for him right now. And maybe that's understandable. That has to change, though, at some point. And Graham spent his entire career in New Orleans playing with a guy in Drew Brees who's really into structure. Everything was systematized there. Yeah, with Russell Wilson, it's different. And we hear about post-up basketball player Jimmy Graham. That's what he's going to have to learn to be in all areas of the field, not just on the red zone. So that's an adjustment for him. I don't think it's going as well as he'd hoped. Those are the concerns with Seattle. But again, this stuff we're talking about, out of structure and the ability of Russell Wilson with that the X factor of his legs, that's really hard to play against. And I would expect that it'll show up positively in this game. I remember last time, I don't know if it was last time they played the Bears, it was Russell Wilson's first year as a starter. But as the game progressed, he killed them increasingly more with his legs, which is something he does to a lot of teams. He's a better runner late in games than he is early in games, a more aggressive runner. I think that will be a factor in this one as well.
To me, if I'm John Schneider, my long-term goal for Russell Wilson is for him to use his legs less and less. And now it seems because of the way their offensive line has been stocked over the years, or not stocked, I think the only guy that makes over $1 million on that line is Russell Okung. And that's just because he was drafted before the new rookie wage scale came in. But to me, if I'm paying a quarterback $20 million a year, I want to keep him safe. And I want him to be a little bit more of a traditional pocket guy and have other guys like Marshawn Lynch taking the beating.
Well, but Robert, if Russell Wilson, if you take the legs out of Russell Wilson's equation, then you'd be paying $20 million to a guy who's worth about
I'm not saying to take them out. I'm just saying his legs shouldn't be having an increased role. It should be the same as last year or less. And what I'm seeing is an increased role.
I would normally agree if you're saying the same or less. But I think in Wilson's case, I disagree because, for one, he's nothing in the pocket. He can't see from the pocket, so he has to play with his legs. For two, he's exceptionally gifted at protecting himself. I watched every one of his runs as 2013, and he did not take one hit at the end of a run in that entire season. He's a great slider, a great feel for angles and spatial awareness. He knows how to fall, which is the opposite of Robert Griffin, who I think Bill Polian described it best once. He says Griffin runs like a hurdler. You don't get that sense with Wilson at all. There's a compactness to him. I think by quarterbacking standards especially, I think he's a safe enough runner. I'd rather get 7 or 8 really great years out of Wilson running around than try to prolong his career to 10 or 12 and protect him.
Well, he certainly has that baseball slide mastered. We said we wouldn't spend too much time on that game because we think we know what will happen. We're going to move on to Colts at Titans. 0-2, the Colts are. Another one of these teams with a great quarterback and high hopes who begin the season 0-2. The Titans are 1-1, having lost to the surprising Browns in Cleveland. What has been the key for opposing defenses, and so far it's been Buffalo and New York Jets against the Colts, in keeping Luck inconsistent?
Well, Luck is playing in a system that calls for a lot of 5 and 7 step dropbacks through the air, and he does not have the offensive line that's physically capable of sustaining that. And these receivers have also struggled at times to get open, particularly against man coverage, which the Bills and Jets might be the two best teams in the AFC at employing. So that's not going to be as big a concern against the Titans defense. It's just not as good in that realm and really is more zone-based anyways. But the pass protection is going to be a continuous concern with them. And as Chuck Pagano said, it's pretty much been a concern throughout Andrew Luck's career.
The other quarterback in this game is somebody that the entire league is watching, along with the number one overall pick, Jameis Winston. We're talking about number two overall pick, Marcus Mariota. He follows up his four touchdown debut performance with a 257 yard game against the Browns, 21 for 37 with two touchdowns. Still as impressive to you as he was in week one, or better or worse?
Probably a tick below as impressive. I thought there were a few instances where he didn't quite process quickly enough what's not open. And that's an element of quarterback that people never think about. And there's no way you can come up with an advanced statistic for this kind of thing. But the really great ones, your Brady's, your Manning's, your Phillip Rivers even, they have an ability to see and quickly eliminate the targets that they know will not be open. And that's how they get through their progression so fast. Young guys almost never have that ability. It takes time to develop. And I think at times it looks like Mariota's still developing that. Now, having said that, he was very good from the pocket against Cleveland, a willingness to make throws with bodies around him. And that to me is unspeakably commendable, because that's the issue that we all wondered about with him coming out of Oregon. And, I wrote in the preview, we've never seen a spread system mobile-based quarterback become a good pocket passer because he's not comfortable throwing with bodies around him. He hasn't had the experience. That doesn't appear to be the case with Mariota. He looks very good so far in that, and he's got a compact delivery, and the quicker you throw the ball, the easier it is to throw with bodies around you.
Andy, would you say that this Colts-Titan matchup could be a hot ticket for years to come?
Is that the SeatGeek tee up? Is that what we're doing?
This is your cue.
All right. SeatGeek app. It's called the SeatGeek app. And when you use our code MMQB, you'll get $20 off your first ticket buy. What this SeatGeek app does, it takes less than a minute to download. It's free on iPhone and smartphones, Android smartphones. It does a ton of things that ticketing sites just don't do. It aggregates from all the big ticket sites. Just like when you search for flights or hotels online, the SeatGeek app pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers, creates a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. They also have a function called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket in the market from 1 to 100 value score, and it plots the best deals on a color-coded interactive map. So it's a one-stop shop for anything you need ticket-wise. To redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter that promo code. It's MMQB in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. Earlier today, Robert and I spoke with Xavier Rhodes, a guy that I reached out to the Vikings about immediately after watching the Lions film, because I thought he was absolutely tremendous for them, and I thought he's been an improving player every year. So here's our conversation earlier from with Xavier Rhodes. Xavier, I think you've gotten steadily improved each year of your career, and here you are now in week two battling Calvin Johnson, probably I would say to a draw. You shadowed him all afternoon. Talk about that matchup and whether you expect to draw similar type of number one receiver matchups moving forward this season.
Yeah, that matchup is pretty tough, you know, with Calvin. You know, everyone knows he's one of the best receivers in the league, so you just got to bring the P's and Q's, and you have to keep your eyes on him and also your hands, because he's fast and also powerful, so you got to stay in front of him and stay around him, you know, because once the ball is in his area, he's good to go out and get it.
Now, Calvin played a little bit in the slot in that game, and you followed him there, which was a little bit different role for you. Do you foresee yourself doing that more in the future? And can you explain to our listeners what's the biggest difference between playing outside and playing in the slot?
I don't know about me playing that role, you know, and not being in the slot. I mean, because, you know, it's whatever the coach is going to want me to be. You know, it's all about how we game plan that week. And whatever it is, that's how I'm going to play it. But playing from slot to the inside, you know, slot is pretty hard because the receiver have more room to work with rather than outside, where you can have like more of the sideline to help you cover the receiver. But, yeah, that's the difference.
Xavier, your head coach, Mike Zimmer, is regarded around the league as one of the best teachers of defensive back play. What are some of the specific things you have learned from him about being a professional cornerback?
I mean, just being on top of the receiver, you know, making hard throws, contested catches for their own receivers, you know, not making it so easy for those guys, you know, because one thing about it, it's hard for a receiver to run his route when you're on top of him, you know, so you're basically cutting the route down. So, you know, and basically being physical with those guys because they don't like, receivers don't like their hands being put on them. So that's one thing he always emphasized on, is once they stay in front, being in tight coverage and putting our hands on them.
Xavier, you've had one interception so far in your career, and yet somewhere around 30 passes defensed. Is there something that, you know, you've worked on this offseason, whether it's, you know, having better hands, being able to make the play, or getting that extra step where you're in position to make the catch? Because unfortunately, cornerbacks are judged in a lot of ways by the interceptions that they get.
Yeah, just, you know, being more confident going getting the ball, you know. That, I won't say confident, just being more aware, you know, stepping, taking that risk and going to get the ball instead of just knocking it down. You know, my goal is going through this year is just going and just trying to get interceptions rather than knocking it down. I'd be in great position to get interceptions, but I choose to just knock it down. So this year is more, you know, going and just get those interceptions rather than knocking it down.
Do you think your guys' run defense contributes to that? What I mean by that, I noticed against the Lions, you guys played two safeties back a vast majority of the snaps, and you still dominated Detroit's running game. How big a deal is that to you, and can you be more aggressive if you know you're going to have safeties back on a regular basis?
I mean, it's a big help, you know. The D-line help us, we help the D-line, you know. So it correlates. It goes with each other, you know. So once those guys stop the run and rush the passer, you know, and make harder throws, quicker throws, and once they stop the run, you make the offense one dimensional, and then we can change up our schemes and our calls and play the pass. So, I mean, it can go hand in hand.
I want to ask you one more thing about a few questions back we asked you about I think you mentioned the press coverage from Zimmer and using your hands. We all know he's big on press coverage. Watching his teams over the years, especially with like Adam Jones in Cincinnati, it didn't seem to me like the Bengals played as much press coverage as you would guess. I'm curious how much freedom you guys have to, you also talk about having to keep receivers in front of you. Press coverage and keeping receivers in front of you, that's a tall order to do both. So I'm wondering how much freedom you guys have in terms of determining whether you're going to be physical or whether you're going to play off coverage, and how much of it Zimmer drills into you what exactly he wants. Is it your choice or the coach's choice?
I mean, the coaches allow us to be comfortable. He allows us to, you know, play comfortable, whatever fits us, you know. You know, he knows I'm more of an aggressor. You know, I like to be in the receiver face and, you know, in jam. So he said, play to your strength, you know. Never deter, never get away from your strength. You know, play to your strength. He once told me, you know, you're big and you're physical, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, work on your weaknesses, but also, you know, stay on your strengths, you know, that will make you, you know. So that's one thing he always told me, just never detour, never get away from your strengths, because that would get you where you're at now.
You guys face the Chargers this week. I believe this is the first time that you get to play him personally. In the time that you've had to study him, are there things that you believe set him apart and make him unique as a passer?
He reads defense really well. He reads the defense really well. Once he read the defense, he makes his checks, and it's good checks because, you know, he's 80% plus and passing completed. So, I guess the checks he's making is the right one. So, he's a smart quarterback, you know, and he makes the right throws, right decisions.
Well, we really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Xavier.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Xavier. The Chargers visit the Vikings this week. Both teams 1-1. The Chargers lost to the Bengals 24-19. The Vikings defeated the Lions 26-16. In this game, Adrian Peterson figures to factor in a big way. In his last two games against the Chargers, he's got 46 carries, 394 yards, 8.5 yards per carry. obviously that's non-divisional. So
it wasn't one of those the record-breaking game, like the single season, single game rushing record.
Yeah,
game. It had to have been. That was years ago.
Yeah, obviously they don't play very often, but definitely watch for that. Andy, in your mind, who is our friend Xavier going to be matched up with on the Chargers?
If they match up, it would probably be Keenan Allen. Well, you know what? I take that back. I think it'll be Floyd. Allen's a better receiver, but Floyd's body type matches up to Rhodes' bigger body type better. I'm glad you asked that, because it occurs to me now. We're going to learn a lot about how the Vikings feel about Rhodes and the rest of their secondary by what they give them assignment-wise. If they put Rhodes on Allen, that'll be one thing. If they match up body types, then that would be more in line with what they've done historically with him, and maybe they're not quite treating him as a true number one corner yet. We'll see.
Another non-divisional matchup, Eagles at Jets. The Eagles are 0-2. The Jets are 2-0. The Eagles' offense sputtered against Dallas, losing 20-10. The Jets dominated the Colts to win 20-7 in a pretty boring game overall. Jets head coach Todd Bowles confirms that Ryan Fitzpatrick will be the starter over Geno Smith whenever he returns from that broken jaw. People are now calling Ikenempali, who broke his jaw, the MVP of the Jets season so far. What has been your impression of Fitzpatrick? Is he especially better than he was with the Bills the last time he was paired up with Chan Gailey? Or is he really benefiting from what's been a strong Jets defense so far?
It's more of the second one. He's been fine at offensively, but Fitzpatrick, he is what he is. And what he is on film is a guy that tends to miss some routine throws and take chances that his arm strength doesn't justify. Now, the nice thing is those chances do have a positive outcome as much as they have a negative outcome. But a 50-50 proposition is not a great scenario for a professional quarterback. He's playing with receivers who don't necessarily, well, in one anyway, Brandon Marshall, who doesn't necessarily have to be wide open in order to make catches. And they've also done a very good job of getting Decker in favorable matchups by spreading out and putting him in the slot. So playing in Gailey's system probably helps the familiarity there. He's quicker in his reads and the understanding where his receivers are distributed. But overall, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point there's talk of Geno Smith getting back in the lineup, just because Fitzpatrick, throughout his career and so far these first two games, is such an aggressive up-and-down player.
When Fitzpatrick does have the ball, he'll be going up against an Eagles defense that has struggled early this season. One of the guys that have been emblematic of those struggles is Byron Maxwell, signed to the Eagles in free agency this season, one of the members of the Legion of Boom, who a lot of people in Philadelphia had high hopes for. Sherman was certainly high on him and believed him to be a very underrated talent during his time there. This season, he's been thrown at 19 times, resulting in 15 completions, 240 yards, two touchdowns, and a 158.3 quarterback rating. The guy never seems to be in the right place at the right time, and in some cases, he's completely beat by four or five steps downfield. What do you think is the deal here?
I think it's a guy who's just not playing well right now. He is being asked to do a little bit of different stuff in Philly than he did in Seattle, mainly in the way he matches up and out of man concepts, or what look to be zone concepts, and they turn into man-to-man. But it's, you know, we're nitpicking now. It's not super different. He's still playing on the perimeter, and in Seattle, they played a lot of man-to-man on the perimeter. The difference here is he has to chase receivers across the field a lot out of their coverage principles. And in Seattle, he often passed those receivers on. But, you know, it's two games. He's played very poorly. He probably can't play much worse. And I think the worst has already happened, the Terrence Williams touchdown at the end of the Cowboys game. So maybe the guy hits his low point now. I'm not too overly worried yet about Byron Maxwell, because I know what he did in Philadelphia. I know the skill sets there. One thing I would consider from the Eagles, they've got Malcolm Jenkins playing the slot right now, and he's okay there, but there are certainly certain receivers in certain scenarios that he does not match up well against. Maxwell was very good in the slot with the Seahawks, mainly when he was played in man coverage. Maybe you'd move him around there a little bit, let him get more comfortable, just a way to put his hands on somebody, get him off an island. I don't know. I'm grasping at a change of scenery solution right now. the Eagles' secondary is not very good collectively, though. If Maxwell's not playing well, it's got a real problem. It's too bad because that front seven is one of the best in the league.
I think this could
against the run. Against the run, that is. By the way, they don't have a great pass rush though.
I think this could end up being one of those free agency situations where you let a guy walk that was, you know, pretty good, adequate, maybe wanted a little bit too much money, and you go out in free agency and get somebody you think has a lot more potential, and you should have just gone with a known commodity. I'm talking about Kerry Williams.
Retaining him because the known commodity was Bradley Fletcher on the other side of the where Maxwell's lining up now. And Fletcher, I watched his first two games with New England, just saw the film on that this morning. In fact, he's as bad against vertical routes this season as he was last season. He really shouldn't be on an NFL field right now. So it's as bad as you think it is, Eagles fans. I don't think you lost a great quarterback in Kerry Williams. I think you lost a terrible one in Bradley Fletcher. And you've got a guy now you paid a lot of money to who hasn't had a great first two games. There's 14 more to go, though.
Yeah. Moving on to Steelers at Rams. Both teams 1-1. The Steelers smashed the 49ers 43-18, ending what some thought would be a Cinderella story for the 49ers this season after a strong opener. The Rams upset by Washington 24-10 after the big win over the Seahawks in week one. Le'Veon Bell is back. So you're welcome, fantasy owners who had the patience to draft a man who would not play for the first 2 weeks of the season.
And Le'Veon Bell is a difference maker, but I think right now Ben Roethlisberger is playing as well as any quarterback in the league, and that would include Aaron Rodgers. Roethlisberger, we don't talk about this enough. This is a guy that made his living as a sandlot QB and drove some coaches and certainly old school drop back quarterbacking gurus. He drove them nuts. Bad habits that he often got away with or just dealt with. And late in his career, he's modified his game to become one of the best precision passers from the pocket in the entire NFL. I would never have forecasted that for him. I never would have predicted it.
Did you happen to catch Judy Batista's NFL.com feature on him last week?
I didn't. What was the thesis?
Well, he talked for the first time in a long time about some of the sexual assault accusations, and he didn't go into specific detail, but he talked about how much he'd matured, and others talked about how much he'd matured as a leader. And I think that his emotional maturation kind of mirrored what you're talking about in terms of on-field discipline.
That's interesting. That's an interesting parallel. And I know he got married to a girl from Pennsylvania, I think it was, a local girl, shortly after that as well. And that's one of those kind of things that, you know, guys like you have the brains to think about, Robert. Nerds like me that just watch the film never consider the personal side of it and how much these guys' personal lives factor in to what goes on in their world. But just like any of us, their personal lives do factor into their work.
Right. Well, on Sunday, the Steelers attempted a two-point conversion following their first two touchdowns. Roethlisberger said, "We'll keep going for them. I love it. I think statistically, it's usually a safe bet to go for those, especially now that they've moved back the field goals. I don't know why more teams don't do it." Do you subscribe to this thinking that two-point conversion should be way more popular?
I haven't thought about it enough. I know they were 2 or 3 on their first PATs, and the one they missed was actually the one they tried to kick, and so they accumulated 4 points instead of what would have been a normal 3 points. I'll say this. The NFL wants this. They want to see this. A two-point conversion to them is much more interesting than the automatic extra point. And ultimately, as a guy that watches film, I think the less a kicker impacts a game and the more the offense or defense impacts it, the better it is for everybody.
See, I feel the opposite. I like the kicking game, and I like tough field goals.
Well, here's the problem with the kicking game, though, Robert. If I were to ask you, all right, we just went over Roethlisberger and why he's become such a good pocket passer, and he can shed sackers. He's got arm strength, precision, accuracy, strong in the pocket, all that stuff. If I were to ask you what traits make Adam Vinatieri so successful over his career, what would you say? And don't say he's good under pressure, because that's not a physical trait.
Well,
see, right there. No, that you already answered it. The pause is the answer.
He's got poise under pressure.
That's not a physical trait.
He always plants his plant foot really well.
Yeah, exactly. See, it's nonsense what you're saying, and it might be true, it might not be true. We're guessing because nobody, and I think even NFL head coaches, really have any idea what goes into kicking. A good kick and a bad kick look almost identical in the process. All that's different is how the ball looks flying through the air afterwards. So to the naked eye, there's nothing to look at in kicking, and I think that's why the NFL wants to slowly ease it out. They're not going to eliminate it altogether, and they shouldn't, but they have these. There's too many kickers right now booting 50-yard field goals, and they look the exact same as the PATs, and they look the exact same as a missed 35-yard field goal. And unless something's blocked, which isn't a part of the kicking game as much, then there's really nothing interesting going on with those plays, or nothing that we can decipher.
I've always felt that they should do it the way it's done in sevens rugby. You ever watch a sevens rugby match?
No, I don't begin to know what you're talking about. Is it regular rugby?
Rugby is typically 15 on 15, and then
in the
summer when it's hot, you play 7 on 7 with athletic guys and none of the big guys. And in like a social tournament setting, when you score, then you're the one who kicks the extra 2 points.
The person who scores?
Yeah, no matter who scores.
Oh, God, come on. You don't want to really see that in the NFL.
Let's go.
Come on. The listeners need to know that you're being facetious.
What the listeners need to know about is FanDuel. Week 3 NFL games are already live in the FanDuel lobby, so you don't have to wait another day to start building your teams. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel, and now it's your turn. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code THEMMQB and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code THEMMQB today. So don't get left out. Don't forget, the code is THEMMQB. FanDuel.com. Try it out today. 49ers at Cardinals. The 49ers are 1-1. The Cardinals are 2-0. The Cards cruise past the Bears 48-23. They, at 2-0, pose a significant threat in the NFC West to the Seahawks, who have fallen behind 0-2, as we've mentioned before. They've scored 79 points in the first 2 weeks. Anomaly, or is this one of these teams that's going to be in the top 5 in scoring when the season is over?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I'll say this. You could argue that no quarterback in the NFL is a better fit for his team's system than Carson Palmer is under Bruce Arians in Arizona. He's exactly what they need there. He reads the field. He's not afraid to pull the trigger on deep intermediate throws. And when I say reads the field, I mean he understands how his route concepts relate to the coverage he's seeing. It's one thing to read the coverage. It's another thing to know your playbook. The great quarterbacks are the ones that marry the two thoughts and understand exactly what progression means what based on what they're seeing. He's as good in the league as anybody at that. And it's a Cardinals offense that's very aggressive in its downfield attack. So as long as Palmer stays healthy, they're not going to put up 35 points every week, but they're capable of on any given week of putting up 35 points.
Palmer, as you mentioned, a huge part of that success, 492 yards, 7 touchdowns, and 1 pick this season. And you mentioned their downfield aggression. They've also been really hot in the red zone, 8 touchdowns on 8 red zone possessions this season. That's one of those statistics like turnovers that you can really look at and say that's a big factor in terms of whether or not you win or lose. Next, moving on, another NFC matchup. Falcons at Cowboys. The Falcons are 2-0. The Cowboys 2-0 after beating the Eagles 20-10. The Cowboys now place Tony Romo on IR, designated to return. They trade for Matt Castle, but you have to figure Brandon Whedon will get the start again. The Falcons have held DeMarco Murray and Rashad Jennings to a combined 1.2 yards per carry. Do you have a lot of hope for a Cowboys offense with Brandon Whedon in charge against this Falcons defense?
I'm not ready to say like this Falcons defense as if it's one of the best defense in the league yet.
You need a larger sample size.
Yes. That's the word we should have done for the drinking game.
Yeah. I was just thinking that, you know, I'm going to start drinking whenever you say sample size.
Well, at this point in the show, you're probably fine. I watched the Cowboys film right before we did this podcast. I watched their offense. What they did differently with Whedon, and I'll be curious to see. Oh, there it is. There's one. I'll be curious to see how, if they do this again, they continued to go out of spread empty sets like they do with Romo, but instead of doing three wide receivers, they kept two tight ends on the field. And the difference in that, if you go two tight ends, then you're likely to face the opponent's 4-3 base defensive personnel. That's a less athletic group, especially in Philadelphia's case last week, because D'Amico Ryans and Hicks were in at linebacker for the injured Kendricks and Kiko Alonso. So it's a less athletic group you're facing, less dimension because teams don't have the same amount of blitzes designed in their 4-3 packages as they do in their nickel personnel packages. And I think that's the way Dallas needs to play with Whedon, because Jerry Jones was right. He exaggerated, but he was right when he said Whedon's a good passer of the ball physically. He can throw the ball. And Jones didn't say this, but Whedon's problem has been with diagnosing what he's seeing and the decisions behind what throws he attempts. And the more you can simplify the game, the better you're going to be with him. You simplify the game by going to simpler personnel, commanding the deep, or, you know, coaxing the defense to putting on their simpler personnel. And you can also keep your full run game at your disposal then. And I believe this run game will get going at some point. I watched that offensive line. It's not playing poorly. It just hasn't played quite well yet. I don't look at the Cowboys and think, oh, they got major problems running the ball. It's a work in progress, and it better pick up, though, because they have a quarterback now who needs it.
Andy, I want to remind you that we have several more games to talk about, and you just went on a five-minute tangent about Cowboys-Falcons.
I know. It's because I just watched the film. It's bad. It's terrible. I'll go quicker.
Bills at Miami. Bills are 1-1. Dolphins are 1-1. From what you saw of the film of Miami against the Jaguars, do you believe the reports that Ndamukong Suh, the big free agent acquisition at defensive tackle, has been going rogue off the play calls on defense?
I did not see any negative repercussions from that behavior, if he did.
Well, that's like LeBron. You know, LeBron goes off script and it doesn't look that bad, but it's
it's a little different, because if he goes off script, he's going to have the ball in his hands and there's only four other guys around him. In football, there's 10 other guys around you counting on you. So there's no guy in the NFL, with the exception of Polamalu, and he was built in that way to go off script. That was part of the script. There's no guy in the NFL who's good enough to just play off script all the time and have everyone around them be fine with it. So if that is going on in Miami, that will be a problem over the long haul. But watching the Jaguars game, I didn't see any instances where it was a problem. I didn't think he was going off script that much. I'm not privy to the play calls, though. I don't know. And someone told Adam Beasley that he was going off script. I assume it's someone from within the organization. It better be, because if it's not, then I think someone's grasping at straws. But I haven't seen the evidence of it.
Yeah, I think usually when that sort of thing comes out, and it happens every couple of seasons, or a couple of times every season. I'm blanking on the last time this sort of thing came out, but usually it's an assistant coach of some sort who wants to shame a player into doing the right thing. Moving on to the Jaguars, they visit the New England Patriots. This looks like a lopsided matchup on paper. Julian Edelman currently has the most targets ever through two games with 33. Do you feel like the Patriots offense is getting one-dimensional, and is that something that the Jaguars can possibly take advantage of with the defense that they have?
It is one-dimensional. They don't run the ball unless you could tell when they were going to run the ball against Buffalo by the formations they used. And anytime they were in a condensed formation, they ran the ball. Anytime they spread out, they threw the ball. It was that simple. And with Tom Brady under center, you're good enough to be that simple, or even, I dare say, predictable, because you might be one-dimensional, but within that one dimension, the passing game, you have multiple dimensions within that. They line guys up in so many different spots. They're the toughest team in the league to match up with personnel-wise, because they play at such a fast tempo, and they've got the Gronkowski factor. So I'm not at all worried about it. There's worse things in the NFL than putting the game in the hands of Tom Brady.
Sure. Moving on to Raiders at Browns, both teams 1-1. The Raiders, as we mentioned before, upset the Ravens 37-33. The Browns defeat the Titans 28-14. Josh McCown, now cleared from the concussion protocol, is surprisingly named the Week 3 starter. They must really hate Johnny Manziel, says says every Browns fan.
Well, and I'm sure Browns fans are probably saying, you know, Johnny gave us a spark and all that kind of stuff. The coaching staff just conducted a quarterback competition over the summer. They know what Manziel is. They know what the plays they're calling are. They know what he is in practice and how this everything's supposed to flow. And taking that into consideration and taking McCown and what they saw from him in the offseason during that camp competition into consideration, they've determined that McCown's still their better option. I don't see how anyone can sit back from afar and criticize the decision, especially because McCown has played like what? Just a few snaps so far, like one quarter for the Browns so far. So we don't even know what McCown is with the Browns.
The other young quarterback in that game, less popular, but certainly with as much or more potential as Derek Carr, 30 for 46 last week, 351 yards, three touchdowns, and one measly interception in that win. Moving on, the Saints at the Panthers. The Saints are 0-2. The Panthers are 2-0. This is a matchup that is very important in the NFC South running, though probably not that important in the big picture. Luke McCown is most likely to start for the Saints in the absence of Drew Brees. Do we have any idea how long that Brees is supposed to be out for?
I think it depends what day you read the news, because this week I have read anywhere from he's out multiple weeks to he's day-to-day to he looks like he's good to go this week. We don't quite know what he is. I'll say this, and we talked about this on the podcast heading into the season because you heard this during the training camp tour around the NFC South. We talk about Peyton Manning's arm strength so much declining. Drew Brees' arm strength is also declining, and that's changing, or at some point it will change the way the Saints have to approach the game. They're a very vertical offense, and right now they have a quarterback who isn't pushing the ball down the field with the same zip and consistency that he has throughout his career.
Yeah. You know what's funny? Luke McCown in these current commercials, I think for Verizon or some cellular network, talking about how if backups would just get a chance that they could be, you know, spectacular. Now he gets a chance.
Yeah, that's been a good ad campaign. I wonder how much they paid him to do that.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody feels like he jinxed Drew Brees with that. I mean, there are superstitious people in the NFL.
Well, there'll be a blogger or tweeter somewhere that comes up with that.
Final game we're going to talk about, final game of the week, Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the Houston Texans. The Bucs are 1-1. The Texans are 0-2. The Bucs win against the Saints 26-19. The Texans lose in the final seconds to the Panthers 24-17. What did Jameis Winston do differently in their win over the Texans to improve on his week one struggles?
You know, I'll be honest, I haven't gotten to that film yet. I was planning on it for Friday. He was very slow in his delivery in week one. Everything about him was methodical at times. And that will be an ongoing issue for them this season. They're going to need pass protection with him, in part because he's a guy right now, he's just reading the field very wide-eyed. So that was week one. I'm real interested, not curious, but interested to see the week two film, because on paper, it looks like there was a drastic transformation.
I did get a chance to catch a bunch of that game, though I didn't break it down
good.
With the All-22. I think the biggest difference to me was that the Saints really didn't get any kind of consistent pass rush, and he actually had some time to sit back and diagnose.
Well, and that was the Saints' problem in week one against Arizona. They have no edge rushing speed, which we knew would be the case once they got rid of Junior Gallette. So that's a big issue moving forward, and I guess now we're going to see weakness score off against weakness. Or I guess not now. I guess that was last week that was the issue, is the Saints' D-line versus the Bucs' O-line. This week it's strength versus weakness because they got J.J. Watt to handle the Bucs' O-line. And kind of to go back real quick to Carolina, who played Houston last week, I feel like we need to mention Mike Remmers, their right tackle. When he went up against J.J. Watt one-on-one, which is often, it was on almost anything that wasn't a seven-step drop back, he played Watt to a draw if he didn't win the matchup outright. Mike Remmers was very good last week against J.J. Watt, and I would expect Watt would bounce back a week later.
It's always interesting to me when guys get these superstar reputations and then they have a season where they're not up to the bar that they once set for themselves, and how that kind of catches on with with media and fans, because for a lot of players, they're able to ride that reputation for, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 years after the fact when they're not necessarily playing at that all-pro level. I'm not saying that Watt is that kind of player right now, but he's certainly not playing as well as he did last year or the year before.
Well, through 2 games he has. I mean, he was dominant, though, in week one, absolutely dominant against Kansas City. So he's essentially 1 for 2 in playing up to his bar. And if he goes 8 for 16 playing up to his bar, he'll still be in the MVP discussion, or at least Defensive Player of the Year discussion, because that bar was set so incredibly high.
Well, we like to finish our show with our non-football recommended reading of the week, because we are well-rounded individuals and we read other things. Andy, did you do your homework?
I did. I finished. I think it was, we maybe forgot this last week, or if we did, I sent this author last week, Lionel Shriver. I finished one of her books that was award-winning a few years ago called We Need to Talk About Kevin. And I just stampeded through the book. It was a lot of fun, and, well, kind of a lot of, it's kind of a dark book, but it read really well, and anything that is written well and reads well, I find enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, my long read for the week was an article by Sonia Smith in Texas Monthly, The Road to Damascus. It's about a reporter named Austin Tice who became a journalist in Syria in the middle of their war, and he was, you know, he got published in the Washington Post. This was 2012, and he was really making a name for himself in international reporting, and then he just disappeared. Really good read if you're into that sort of thing. We'd like to thank our producers, Alex Abnos and Dan, always in bloom, our research extraordinaire, John Dangle. Until next week, I'm Robert Klimko. Signing off for Andy Benoit, this has been the MMQB Podcast. Thanks for joining.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.